what we're going to do now is we have a panel here of various people in at Yeshiva University starting, and people are going to share their experiences with Rabbi Kahn. Starting, we have Rabbi Saul Berman. As you heard, you know, he was the one who brought him here, so thank you on behalf of all of us here. We have Rabbi Berger and Rabbi Nachbar, who are Rebbeim at GPATS. We have Nechama Price, who's the director of GPATS and a faculty member, undergraduate, and Dr. Dina Rabinovich, who's the head of the Jewish Studies Department here, and myself, Shoshana Schachter, the Associate Dean of Torah and Spiritual Life here. Really, this is personal experiences, share personal thoughts with our community. We had a program yesterday, and this is for our community here and our Beit Midrash. So without further ado, Rabbi Berman. Thank you.
Thank you. In 1976, when Rav Soloveitchik, in fact, gave the opening shiur of the Beit Midrash here at Stern College, this Beit Midrash did not exist. Yeah, that's the picture on the wall, right? This room did not exist. The Beit Midrash was set up through the good graces of Dean Bacon in what was then the most beautiful room in the building, which is now the research library. After much work on attempting to create that Beit Midrash, it was at the last moment, really, that Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik's son, informed me that his father had agreed to come give the opening shiur. He did not know in advance that that was going to happen. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik felt very strongly that the beginning of the Beit Midrash needed to be marked with an event that would sort of mark it forever. And it did. That was the room in the picture that you can see up there on the wall. Dean Bacon and Dean Orlean sitting, you know, behind myself and Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Lamb, who was then president of the university. Rav Soloveitchik, at the end of his talk, I mean, at the end of his shiur, he started out giving the shiur on the first mission of Masechet Pesachim. He was one who decided that the students should learn Masechet Pesachim that year. But he wanted them to learn, you know, the 10th Perek, which is practical and, you know, will introduce them in a way that would appeal to them, he felt, but he wanted to open the Mishnah because he wanted to open with the first Mishnah in the Masechet. And he did that. And then as he finished his shiur, he said that he wants to speak personally to the students for a few moments. He then proceeded to do something that I had heard him in a slightly different form do on one or two other occasions subsequently. Rabbi Blau certainly will remember on one or another occasion having heard Rav Soloveitchik do this. The Rav spoke about his experience of studying Torah, his experience of sitting at the table and being engaged in the study of Torah. And gradually, as he's sitting and studying the texts of Halakha, he is suddenly joined by others. That he is joined by Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. And then he's joined by Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. And gradually, he is joined by not only Tanoim, he's joined by Amoraim, by Rav and Shmuel, and he's joined by Ravina and Ravashi. And then he's joined by Gaonim and Rishonim. He's joined by the Rif and the Rambam, by Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, and ultimately they're all now engaged with him. He's not alone. He's not alone at the table. He's there with all of the Chachmei HaMesoret. And that this was his community of the Masoret with whom he was learning. And then finally he would get to the Gra, Vilna Gaon and his grandfather, Reb Chaim, and they were all with him there. And then he said he wants to invite the students who are sitting in front of him at that moment in time to join him in this community of the Masoret, to become part of this community of people who learn Torah and who live Torah. And that's the purpose of his being there. On the way out, after the shir ended, Rav Soloveitchik told me one other thing. He said, you know, at that point in time, Rav Soloveitchik was almost a lone voice, simply in asserting the permissibility of women learning Gemara, let alone actually implementing it to that degree in the reality. We had 60 students sitting in that room who had decided that they wanted to study Gemara intensively in that first year that the Beit Midrash existed. And Rav Soloveitchik said to me, he said, listen, there's something else you should tell them in my name, he said. You should tell them that if when they get home and they describe to their parents and their families and their boyfriends that they're taking a course in Gemara and that they're learning, they're sitting and they're harving in Torah, and if somebody says to them, what? You're learning Gemara? Bistacha Meidel, right? You're just a girl, right? Said Rav Soloveitchik, tell them that they should not answer them. They should just tell them that they should come to me, said Rav Soloveitchik, and I will answer for them. They should not take them on. I will answer for them. And he did, as some of you know, over the course of the subsequent months, after that picture was actually published on the front page of one of the Yiddish newspapers, with a long story which had lots of falsehoods in it, you know, sort of exaggerated stuff that was really quite imaginative on the part of the reporter who wrote the article, there was actually an attempt to put Rav Soloveitchik into Cheren. And there were some 7 or 8 major Russia yeshiva here in the United States who were willing to sign on to this Cheren, to put Rav Soloveitchik and Stern College into Cheren because of this study of Torah. And it was only stopped because Rabbi Moshe David Tendler Zatzal told us that Rav Moshe was under enormous pressure, that Rav Moshe Feinstein, his father-in-law, was under enormous pressure to sign on to this Cheren. And that Rav Moshe was not going to do that. He was not going to sign on, but we should just know that the pressure on Rav Moshe was really enormous for him to sign on to it. As a result of which, we decided that it was important for Rav Moshe to know what the facts were, because the story in the Allgemeine Journal had you know, offered all sorts of imaginative stuff. I must tell you, some of that imaginative stuff is now real, but 40 years ago, that was very imaginative. In any case, you know, someone had really a rich sense of what was possible. It was just that to the rest of the Jewish world, it would seem crazy, but and to Rav Moshe, it would have seemed crazy. So we decided to send one of the people who was teaching Gemara at the time and a number of students to meet with Rav Moshe Feinstein. And they actually went and met with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein opened the meeting by saying to them, you don't have to come to me for haskama, he says. If Rabbi Yoshua Ber Soloveitchik said, he spoke in Yiddish, but he said, if Rabbi Yoshua Ber Soloveitchik said that this is mutter, he said, then it's mutter. There's nothing to talk about, he said. But he would be interested in hearing what they're doing, and we then, you know, explained to him everything that was, or the learning that was taking place, and that satisfied him, and he, in fact, resisted signing, and the result was that the attempt failed. But it is now, you know, more than 40 years later. It's 46, 47 years later. And there's no question in my mind that while I've been involved over the course of my early years here at Stern College as chairman of the Department of Jewish Studies, was involved with the selection of many faculty members, many of whom are still faculty members here at Stern College, and some of whom are either gone elsewhere or gone to a different world. I think in many ways, the singularly most important appointment that I made was the appointment of Rabbi Moshe Kahn to teach Gemara. Why? So Rav Moshe Kahn never told me that he had the kind of mystical experience that Rav Soloveitchik was describing. I mean, had he told me that he had that kind of experience, I would not have questioned him, because he would never have said anything that was not fully and perfectly true, right? But he never told me that. But it's clear to me that he introduced two generations of young women to the great figures of halacha. He introduced all of those people whom Rav Soloveitchik described as his circle of the Masoret. Moshe Kahn introduced all of those people to his Talmidim. I might have added, Rav Yosher Ber did not mention Rav Zachariah Halevi, the Baal HaMor, the Ramban, and the Milchamos, but those of you who study with Rav Kahn know that he would definitely introduce, you know, those particular representatives of the Masoret to his students. But he embodied the capacity to enable students to engage in the search inside the text of being able to elicit the true will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? That was the mastery that he cultivated. The ability, and that's why the text was so important, because the text is what embodied the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if you really want to know the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you have to know that text carefully and perfectly and precisely, with precision and care, and with a sense that that text has the capacity to communicate to you the way in which you can link to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the rest of your life. And he was able to do that. I did not then, or I must tell you now, albeit now I have much less contact with people who are doing this. I did not know anyone who could do that in the way that Rabbi Moshe Kahn could do it. With the sense of love of the students, with the sense of caring for each one of them singly, he helped shape that first broad base of Jewish women for whom the study of Talmud and Rishonim was not mysterious, as Rabbi President Berman said, was not foreign, and it was not usher. But as Rav Soloveitchik at that time, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe at around the same time, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in a short time after that, as they insisted that the study of Torah was not just not usher, but that the study of Torah for women was a kiyum mitzvah of Talmud Torah at its highest possible level, precisely because it embodied within itself the fulfillment of the mitzvot of Avat Hashem, which was the position of Rav Soloveitchik, of Yirat Hashem, which was the position of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which was a strange reversal for the Chassid and the Litvak, right? And the position of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who maintained that it was the highest form of kiyum, of the position of the Ramban, who maintained that the mitzvah of not forgetting Maamar Har Sinai meant that every single Jew, men and women, every single Jew, that it was incumbent upon every single Jew to forge their whole identities into a link from the moment of Matan Torah till the end of time, that there's a chain that is formed in the Masoret from the moment of Har Sinai, and that every one of us has the capacity to be a link in that chain of Torah that will lead till the end of time and continue forever. And that's the mitzvah of not forgetting Maamad Har Sinai. Wherever we are in that chain, we have to understand that our role in that chain is as vital as any other link. And that if we are absent from that chain is weakened. And if we are present in that chain is strengthened. And between Rav Soloveitchik and Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, there was a different sense of what was possible in the vision of women, of what it means to be learning Talmud and to be learning Torah at the highest possible level. It was a transformative moment, precisely because up until then, the fundamental approach of those who supported the teaching of Talmud for women was a concessional approach. It was that Nebucharachmanus, you know, the Deres and Gevur and Shvacher, I mean, in ancient time, right, the Chavetz Chaim, the language of the Chavetz Chaim, right, in previous years, it was really possible for women to become, you know, really who they needed to be as Jewish women simply by absorbing the Masoret in their homes, right? But nowadays, said the Chavetz Chaim, you know, Bavel Nosenu Arabim, due to our many sins, that's not what the generation is like. This is how he was talking in the late 1800s already, right? That women don't even necessarily live in the same communities as their parents, that they study foreign languages, that they study other subjects, and they, you know, so how can we keep them linked to Yiddishkeit? So we have to teach them some Chumash, and we have to teach them some Musar, and we have to teach them maybe Pirkei Avos, maybe not, it's Mishnah after all, so, you know. But okay, maybe, you know, that's okay. And the approach that Rav Soloveitchik and Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein formed had a totally different character to it. Because it meant that it was not a concession. It's not just Nevach Rachmanis that you have to study Torah because that's the only way you'll be able to remain true. It's that because you are firm and want to confirm your link to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the most intense possible way and at the highest possible intellectual and spiritual level, then you have to study the word of Hashem that is embedded in the totality of Halacha, in the totality of Torah. And Rav Moshe Kahn was able to convey that. He was able to convey it in his own quiet, humble way, systematically, persistently, never giving up on anyone, and always believing that everyone's capacity was greater than what they thought it was. And one other element that made him sort of the perfect medium of this transformation, because what we now see and what is coming in the reality is that the broad base of women who are now studying Torah at very high levels will yield from within itself, organically, from that broad base, will emerge sturdy trees which will grow up to the Shamayim, will grow the select few, built on this sort of pyramid of those who will be supporting them and sustaining them because they understand the value of what they are doing, who will devote their lives to being fully and totally the shapers of the Masoret of the coming generations. And he laid the groundwork for that. But there was one other piece to this that I think is essential, and with that I'll end. Rav Moshe did not just introduce his students to intellectual giants. He introduced them to feeling human beings. Gdelim as feeling human beings. Poskim as feeling human beings. who understood that the essential purpose of halacha was not just to get them to comply with rules, but to enable people to achieve lives of chesed and of goodness, lives that not only conformed with the rules of halacha, but lives that embodied the actual midot of chesed of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in daily life, in every element of the human experience. Because halacha addresses every element of the human experience, and it's an attempt to transform every element of the human experience into the context in which the qualities of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the midos of Chesed, of Hashem, Hashem, Keil, Rachum, V'chanun, Erech Hapayim, Rav Chesed, V'emet, right? All of those qualities can be translated into reality in the world through Torah. And that was because Moshe embodied those qualities himself. He was. He embodied all of those qualities. He was creative. He thrived on interdependence. He was responsive to other people. He offered unearned love. He manifested empathy. Not only in his teaching of Torah, I mean, it was the same in his late career shift into as a psychotherapist. I mean, I can, you know, all right, in any case, he was such an embodiment of trustworthiness, right, of emet, of so having the capacity for gratitude, even when it was not really earned by people. Nevertheless, he was grateful to people for whatever they did. His humility, which has been commented upon often. I think it's that combination of this, you know, the intellectual rigor, and at the same time, this spiritual awareness, spiritual depth, that empowered him to open the world of Mesoret to a new generation and an entire new population. And you, all of you, will be not only the beneficiaries of all of that, all of your lives, but your offspring, Amir Sashem, will also ultimately be the beneficiaries of that extraordinary work that he has done. Yehi Zichro Baruch, and the family should have nachat.
Wow. I didn't know. Did you know a lot of what Berman just shared? That's incredible. The history. Thanks for giving us the history of Rabbi Kahn coming. You know, I'm certainly, I'm Shoshana Schechter, the associate dean here of Torah and spiritual life. And I'm here today as a Talmidah of Rav Kahn. When I took this job in Stern, I was very overwhelmed. I'm sure everybody here has experienced imposter syndrome. Finding myself taking elevators with Rabbi Kahn, I had major imposter syndrome. He's not a colleague of mine. You know, I'm here at Stern. Seeing Dr. Schatz here, I had the same feelings about you, by the way. And, you know, all my Rebbeim, and just being in the presence and being in this on the same faculty as my Rebbeim, was quite intimidating. And Rabbi Kahn always made me feel special as a Talmidah when I was a Talmidah. And then when I was here, you know, I would see him, and he was always so happy to see me in that same smile that always terrified me in class. In fact, when I came, you know that what everybody's saying is true because everybody's saying the same thing. So, you know, I remember sitting in his shiur. I took Advanced Talmud with Advanced Gemara with Rabbi Kahn, and also Halacha with Rabbi Kahn. I'll talk about that in a second. But I found myself not wanting to make eye contact because, well, you weren't sure exactly. If you made eye contact, he would call on you. But I think if you didn't make eye contact, he was more likely to call on you. So it was always that sort of balance, like, do I or don't I? And when I started teaching here, I found myself, you know, in an elevator, one of my first days here at the Vicon, and not making eye contact and thinking, he can't even call on me. There's nothing to call on me about. But, thinking, I'm not making eye contact. I'm not prepared. What are you not prepared for? I was taking an elevator with him. So it was very, very special on a personal level to come here and work here side by side with Rabbi Kahn. So I just wanted to just, again, share a couple thoughts. It's funny, my first line here, I this is more personal recollection. So I didn't really write anything out. I wrote a couple notes. And my first note here is, Lo bashamayim hi, ki karov elecha davar amon. I'm sitting here going, okay, where's this going? So that's what happens when you're not the first speaker. But I wanted to say, similar to what President Berman was saying, that when, you know, Moshe at the end of his life is telling B'nai Israel, I mean, the whole Sefer Dvarim is so powerful. It's I like to call it Moshe's last lecture. You know, he's about to die. He wants to give over anything he can, everything important, all the fundamentals to B'nai Israel, knowing that his mission is over. And even then, you know, he was fighting to, the Medrash says, you know, to not die. And he wanted to continue to live, to continue giving over the Torah. And Hashem said, you know, you did that. It's the last line in the Torah. Like, they call Yisrael. Like, this is, you know, all the Moftim, Otot, and Moftim, you fulfilled your mission. You brought this. And this is, again, similar to what Rabbi Berman said, that Moshe ends with, Lo bashamayim hi, velo me'ever layam. It's not anymore in shamayim. It's not anymore me'ever layam. Ki karove lach hadavar ma'od, b'fichal b'lavcha lasoto. It's close to you. And it's close to you because Moshe brought it close to you. So Rabbi Berman said that already. But then, just to take it one step further, And one of my favorite parts of this pasuk, when, you know, ki karove lacha davar ba'on, how is it karove lacha davar? How is it so close to you? And the Gemara in Erevin says, Rava ama Rava, what does he say? How do you make it karove lacha davar ma'od? Asuma dimla Torah. Make time to learn. That's how you make it close to you. That's what Rabbi Kahn did. It wasn't just the making the time to learn. Yes, we've heard, and I'll just say again, he could have taken any job teaching men. He would have been offered, he would have been one of the Rosh Yeshiva already by now on the Wolf campus. No, I mean, he was a tremendous Talmud of the Rav, tremendous Masmid, and he could have done that, and he could have taken that route, but he wanted to be here. He chose to be here. This is why we wanted this Shloshim here. We had a beautiful Shloshim yesterday in Tinak, in Rinat, for the community. This is his Makom. This base Medrash is his Medrash, is his legacy. And that's all he wanted. In fact, I don't recall a Beit Midrash in the reference section of the library. I don't know if anybody here recalls that. I don't remember any Beit Midrash, honestly, except maybe one little room in Brookdale on the fourth floor or something. But great if we had it, right? You were here with me at some point. Right. Second floor. That's how much, you know, it was used. Just being in this beautiful room is Rabbi Kahn's legacy. And that's why it was very important for us to have this here in this room. This is Rabbi Kahn's legacy, a Beit Midrash filled with women who just want to learn and connect to Hashem. And that's when Rava says, Asumu Adim LaTorah. That's what Rabbi Kahn wanted to do. He wanted us to make time to learn and do it properly. And so many things that Rabbi Berman said, I remember discussing this with him. I was editor of The Observer. I once interviewed Rabbi Kahn about women's learning. Same stuff over and over. You look at my Observer issues, you know, elevator broken, women's learning. Like, it's the same. Calf price is high. You know, it's the same stuff. But I had these conversations with Rabbi Kahn. And in fact, it's funny. I remember the one time I wanted to do a whole article about women's Torah learning. And of course I went to speak to Rabbi Kahn about it. And it was just, he had so much to say, and I didn't have time to put everything together because I was editor of that year of The Observer. And so I asked an early admission freshman who had just started here, somebody named Shani Feiner, who ended up becoming Shani Targan. And I said, you covered this article about women's Torah. And she did. And you could look at back copies, Women's Torah Learning by Shani Feiner. Anyway, and Rabbi Kahn, that's all he wanted to do. We've said this. All he wanted to do was bring us closer to Torah on the highest of levels. And I remember him saying, you know, you're learning math and physics and sciences on the highest levels. Of course you need to learn Torah in the highest levels. And I remember talking to him about Yediyat Hashem and Ahavat Hashem. He's like, we have an obligation. Are women obligated in Limud Torah? Are women obligated in Yediyat Hashem? Well, how else are you getting to this point of knowledge of Hashem, of Yediyat Hashem, if you're not doing it on, if you're not learning Torah and you're learning on the highest of levels? And yes, I feel repeating a little bit, but as a Talmidah, what Rabbi Berman said, this is why every word was important to him. This is why I was terrified in Shir, right? You couldn't fudge your way through Rabbi Kahn's, you know, if you unfortunately made eye contact and got called on, and then you couldn't fudge. If you weren't prepared, you weren't prepared. And of course, you know, he would always say it very nicely. They did call him Killer Kahn. I don't know. I think somebody mentioned this a little bit. Yes. Yeah. Yes, they did. He was the nicest, sweetest, most humble Killer Kahn that you'll meet. But he didn't let you get away with anything with the most love. I mean, he had the best combination of Ahava and Yira. That is the perfect combination in a mechanech. And it's interesting because I had him a long time ago, and it's the same things. Like, I love talking to the GPET students and the Advanced Gemara students because we all had similar experiences. Like, it was the same experiences that we all had, but he did it because he wanted us to connect to Torah. And some of you have heard me give this example, but I thought of this because of Rabbi Kahn. And I apologize for those of you who heard me say this before, but when I have students that ask me, because I bother my students also about words. Like, why is this word important? So I like to give the example that if you get a text from somebody, let's say you worked in a summer camp. I've given this example, but I think it really, Rabbi Kahn was the one who made me think of this. You know, you work in a camp, let's say this resonates with young women, and you meet this guy and you're interested, and then he sends you a text after the summer and he says, you know, hey, Miriam, I'd love to hang out with you soon. Smiley face emoji, Josh. Like, what do you do with that text? You show it to your 2,000 closest friends and you're like, what does this mean? You know, why did he say, hey? Why didn't he say dear? Why did he say love and he didn't say like? Why did he say hang out? What does hang out mean? What exactly does it mean? Is it me? Is it the whole chevra? Is it soon? What does soon mean? Is soon like now? Is soon in 10 minutes? Is soon next month? Is soon like, yeah, when we have a reunion at some point? Like, what? Smiley face emoji? There's a smiley face. It's a big smile. There's no teeth showing. There's no hearts in the eyes. Like, what does this mean? And the reason that we care about this is because we care about the relationship. We want to know what every word means because this is the relationship we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why we can't fudge the words. We want to understand what's behind every single word. That's why Rabbi Kahn cared. That's why he wanted us to get every word. Like Rabbi Berman said, this was our connection to the Masorah. This was how we were going to come to knowledge, love, Ahavat Hashem, Yediyat Hashem, and to take our place in the Masorah and in our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why he was the perfect person for this and the perfect pioneer of women's learning, because that's what his agenda was. You don't often have that. And hearing all the background and all the history, I can't imagine anybody, you know, putting Rabbi Kahn in Chayrim. Like, he just, all he wanted was to bring us closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the beauty of this all. He didn't get caught up in the politics. You know, even, you know, famous psak that he came up with, it wasn't to start a fight. He just knew women. He knew, he understood us. He understood the emotional side of us. He understood our emotional needs. He just wanted to do the right thing. He wanted us to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why he was so perfect for really creating something amazing in terms of Limud HaTorah. He was always... A lot of people have spoken about his anava, the humility. He was always surprised that he had all these chassidot. You know, I mean, it was borderline stalking. I'm just saying, shut up at your house. For sure, Purim, we would come every Purim. But other times, we would pass by your house sometimes. But he was always genuinely surprised, like, oh my, you know, like my Talmid don't want to show up on Purim. And I don't think he realized like how much we, probably the word is idolized, or, you know, I wouldn't say obsessed because that's just creepy, but just looked up to him and just, you know, wanted to learn from him. And if you did get called on and you were prepared properly and you got every word right, oh my gosh. I mean, you were on a high, and he would say you did good, you know, or good. Sometimes it's just good. And you were just flying high for the longest time because you got that, you know, you made him proud. We wanted to make him proud. I had the opportunity of spending time outside of Stern with him sometimes at the Nefesh conference. There's a conference that Chana Khan, Rabbi Khan's wife, was very instrumental in organizing. It's a conference for Jewish for mental health professionals, and my husband's a psychologist, and he is a colleague of Chana Khan. So I would go, I would go in these Nefesh conferences as a tag along. Because my husband presented and I was a tag along. Well, I was in great company because Rabbi Khan was also a tag along. And that was, I have to tell you, those Nefesh conferences, I spent a lot of time with him because we were tag alongs. Our spouses were very involved and, you know, lecturing. This was probably while he was getting his degree or even before. Some of it was before. I don't know. He was there for a long time. So, right. but very low key. And, you know, there were so many times, you know, I would say to him, and I felt very honored. I got to spend special time with him at these conferences. Our spouses were busy. And, you know, I would say to him, like, people don't even know the godless of who's here with them. Like, people don't know that Rabbi Khan is there. Like, and I would say to him, people here don't even know who you are and what you do. And he would say to me, it's better that way. And I remember one time, I know you have a recollection of a different story. It might've been the same, but I think it was different. But I actually was privy to this. Some of these stories we shared with Rabbi Khan, we had such a wonderful visit with Rabbi Khan a couple months ago. It was very, very special to spend time and, you know, share with him some of these thoughts and some of these memories, some of these recollections. And so I remember, and I was there when somebody said to him, I think I started, maybe I was pushing buttons a little bit, but somebody came over to, you know, talk to us and they said, oh, so what do you do? And I said, you know, I'm a Tanakh teacher. And they said to Rabbi Khan, you know, what do you do? And he said, you know, I'm also a Torah teacher. And of course I had to say, well, he actually teaches Gemara, you know, on a very high level to women. This is a little more of a yeshivish, clientele over here. And I said, actually, he teaches, you know, Gemara in a very high level to women. And this person turned to Rabbi Khan and said, really? Why? And Rabbi Khan just, I don't think he really understood the question. And he even said, like, I don't really understand your, like, I don't even know how to respond because, like, I don't understand that question. Like, no one's saying to me, why are you teaching Tanakh? And to him, that's what it was. It was a way, learning was a way to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's all, we keep talking about the agenda. That's what his agenda was. And I just want to end with one thought where, back to Dvarim, because I love Sefer Dvarim. And again, you know, Moshe is about to die and he's giving over, you know, these last minute messages to Bnei Israel to make, you know, he wanted to ensure that they were going to stay connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to Torah, you know, knowing that he's dying and wanting to make sure of that. So one of my favorite psukim, he says, before Lo Bashamayim, earlier in the Sefer, he says, Vata Yisrael, and I apologize to those of you who heard me say this also, but this is also very personal in terms of Rabbi Khan. Vata Yisrael, Ma Hashem Elkecha Sh'al Mimcha. What does Hashem ask of you? Now, Bnei Yisrael, what does Hashem ask of you? Ki im li yirat Hashem Elkecha, lalechet b'chol drachav, la'ava oto, lavodat Hashem Elkecha, b'chol uavcha, b'chol nafshecha, lishmort mitzvot Hashem v'et chukotav asher nochi mitzavcha yom, letov lach. One long sentence. And now, Bnei Israel, what does Hashem ask of you? Only to fear him, to follow in his paths, to love him, to worship him with all your heart and all your soul, to follow the mitzvahs of Hashem and the chukim that I'm commanding you today, letov lach, because it's good for you. And of course, there's a lot of questions on this pasuk and the question that the Gemara in Brachos poses, The Atay Yisrael Masham Akacha Shoel Mimcha Atu Yirat Shamay Milta Zutrasahi. Is fear of Hashem and all this dedicating your life to Hashem, is it a small thing? The way Moshe says, Masham Al Kacha Shoel Mimcha, what does Hashem ask of you? No biggie, just dedicate your life 24/7 to Him. So is this a small thing, the Gemara asks? And the Gemara's response is, no, it's not a small thing, but what? Legabe Moshe milta zucha sahi. To Moshe, it's a small thing. And then the Gemara continues. I think the pshat in the Gemara is, you know, the Gemara continues and says, you know, it's like a rich man asking a poor man, you know, saying, what's the big deal? It's $1,000. It's not a thousand gold pieces. It's not a lot. For the poor man, it's a lot. So you look at that answer and you're like, you know, I think that's pshat in the Gemara. But it's a little bit unnerving, you know, what Moshe would say, that it seems like an insensitive thing for a rich man to say to a poor man. And why would Moshe say that to Bnei Israel? Well, so maybe he was such an unav, Moshe, that he really didn't understand that he was so much better than everybody else. And that's why, I mean, if I could do it, you could do it. You know, I'm not so much better than you. So maybe that's one way of understanding it. And then other Mefarshim talk about this beautiful, you know, Rav Albo and Sefer Yikarim talks about, you know, the key, and the Ramban talks about before the Sefer Yikarim that the key is Latovlach. That ultimately, yes, it doesn't mean it's easy. It's effortful, but ultimately it's Tovlach. You have your reward is a meaningful existence. I always talk about a 613 step recipe for a meaningful existence. Like, that's the reward. So ultimately it's tovlach. It's effortful, you know, it's rigorous, but ultimately there's an amazing reward. You get a connection with the creator of the world. So yes, it doesn't mean it's easy, but this is the way to connect to God. So this is a recipe, and that's why letovlach. And I was just sharing this thought with Rav J.J. Schachter, who spoke beautifully at the Leviathan, and he told me there's a whole history also with his family and your family. And he said to me, and I'm telling you, I called him after the Leviathan, and I said, this is Pshat, and this is Rav Moshe Khan. He said to me the following. He said, when the Gemara says, Legabe Moshe Milta Zusha Sahi, so what does Legabe mean? So clearly the Pshat in the Gemara is that Legabe means to Moshe. To Moshe, it's a small thing. But he says, really, what else can legabe mean? Legabe, when you're legabe someone, you're parallel to them. You know, like a gabai, you're in the presence of, so you're near them. Your gab is your back. It's right next to you. So when you're legabe someone, you are near them. So it's not just that legabe Moshe to Moshe, it's a small thing, which again, I think is pshat in the Gemara. If you look at the examples the Gemara gives in Brachos. But legabe means when you're in the presence of someone like Moshe, then milta zuta sahi. Then it's not a big thing. Again, not a big thing doesn't mean it's effortless. It's hard, but you want to do it. You want to buy in. You want to be part of this because you're legabe. When you're legabe Moshe, then milta zuta sahi. When you have a model like Moshe, yes, then it's rigorous. It's effortful. But you want to do it. You'll do it because ultimately, letovlach. And that's what I felt about Rabbi Khan. And of course, Rav Moshe, another Moshe. Moshe LaMoshe, Lokam Kimoshe, right? That's what Rabbi Khan, that was the godless. It was rigorous, his classes. It was hard, his classes. I once gave him a problem because of the grade that I got. And okay, it was 25 years later. I happened to see my transcript. And he was, you know, I confronted him. I gave my whole class the notes, and he's like, do you want me to change it now? I'm like, yes, yes, I do. Thank you very much. But it was legabe. You went, you sat in his class. You made sure you were prepared. It was rigorous. It was hard. But when you were legabe Moshe, when you were in the presence of Rav Khan, then milta zuta sahi, then you wanted to be part of this. Then it wasn't, there was no question because ultimately letovlach. Because look what we gains from that experience and from that relationship. And he made it seem he didn't, what you said, he had faith in all of us, every single person, no matter where you came from. He said he had more faith in us than sometimes we had in ourselves. And that's what the godless, legabe Moshe milta zuta sahi. When you're in the presence of a Rebbe like Rabbi Khan, you wanted to push yourself. You wanted to learn. You didn't mind the rigor. You didn't care that it was called Killer Khan. You wanted to be in this environment. You wanted to be in his presence because you wanted to connect to Torah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I just hope, again, I didn't, you know, acknowledge Rabbi Kahn's wife, Hannah, and her family, and the Ein Seidler's Rabbi Kahn's sister and her family. I hope that this, you know, all the outpouring and all the love and all the generations, and, you know, we talk about Talmidot and Grand Talmidot, and, you know, so much of you know, so many, many, many Mechanchot out there who were Talmidot of Rabbi Kahn. And I want to add here, not just for Gemara. Yes, he was a pioneer in Gemara, but he was a pioneer in Halacha also. Everybody took Halacha with Rabbi Kahn. Doesn't matter where you came from. Doesn't matter whether you were into learning Gemara or not into learning Gemara. You still learned Halacha. He was a pioneer in Halacha. He taught us Derech HaLimud. He didn't just read from the Mishnah Brura. He didn't just tell us Dinim. He showed us the Halachic process because he wanted us to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Legabe Moshe Milter Zutra Sahi. And I hope that all of this outpouring, and you see the impact he had on all of us and me personally, and so many generations of women. You know, if you weren't a student of his, if you weren't Zocha to be a student of his, you're a student of a student of his. I guarantee it. And I hope that brings Nechama to the family.
Good evening. In my family, we have this saying, don't speak after Uncle Mordechai. My uncle, Rabbi Mordechai Schneidman, is a gifted speaker, and inevitably, at every family simcha, it doesn't matter what you prepared as your Dvar Torah, he managed to get that idea in if he spoke before you. I've learned to quit while I'm ahead. I'm telling a story. I have really two Rabbi Kahn stories. One I'm going to allude to. If you want more of the details, you have to come and see me privately. And that's how I got to be listed in Rav Aaron Kahn's shir, Uptown, when I was registered here to take Gemara. It was my first semester taking him. It was in fall of 1984. The second will relate to the second class, or the last class that I took with Rav Kahn. And this was spring already of 1986. And Rabbi Berman, if you refer to what I think of as one of the articles about the Rav, it's Rabbi Tzvi Patinsky when he talks about the Masorah. It's one of the articles with which I start my seminar in teaching Jewish studies, that's what we're aspiring to. I'm going to refer a little bit to another article that I like to quote of the Rav, his tribute to the Talaner Rebbetzin, where he talks about two different types of Masorah that you get. And I want to say, I look around this room and the sense of Masorah and the sense of continuity. I see people who were with me in Stern in the 80s. I see our daughters. And I see people in between. And it's quite a sense of this link, the shalshelet that we've been able to produce. So in his tribute to the Talmud Rebbetzin, he talks about two different types of Torot that there are, the Torat Avicha and the Torat Imecha. So the Torat Imecha is what you learn at home from your mother. He uses it to describe what we would call an education, the affective. I'm going to use it to describe all the times that I spent in the kitchen with my mother learning about kashrus, especially staying up with her the night before Pesach, and what I've hoped I've transmitted to my children as well, though my daughter can say, I don't make them stay up that late with me erev Pesach. What is the Torat Avicha then? More of the learning of the rationale of the terms. And that I got from Rabbi Kahn in all subjects in Kashrut. The final for this subject was June 2nd, 1986. You might be asking me, how on earth do I remember so specifically when the final was? Because 6 days later, I was getting married and it was the last final I had to take. And no, they weren't any more understanding then than they were now about when you're allowed to miss a final. And I was told quite emphatically that I had to go and take the final, and whatever I got, I got. I didn't study that much for the final. It just was beyond my capabilities at that point. And I remember writing a note afterwards, you know, that desperate note you write to professors at the end. Please, Rabbi Kahn, don't assume that the kashrus of my future home is being reflected in this final. I felt so embarrassed of all subjects not to be able to corner and to really know. However, what I can say is 36 years later, when I have something going on in the kitchen, and who doesn't? It's yes, it's the Torah Timecha, but it's also the Torah Tevicha, the different terms, the different understandings of what it meant to keep a kosher household, that I'm able now to transmit to my son and to my daughters when the occasion comes. And that's the legacy of his that I take with him. And thank you.
Mm.
Hi, everyone. First, I just want to thank the Khan family for joining us here today. Over the last number of months, I've truly had the honor and privilege to speak about Rabbi Khan and reflect about his legacy, including yesterday at the Siyam and the Shloshim event. But as I stand here in the Beit Midrash staring at his picture, it just feels very different. So like some a lot of you, I spent a lot of years in the Stern Beit Midrash. And that time it was on the sixth floor. I don't know what the seventh floor, the second floor, but the sixth floor, which is now my office, actually. I sit there permanently now. But I sat there for 5 years, and all those 5 years studying for Rabbi Khan's Gemara tests and learning for Rabbi Khan's class. And I always reflect on the fact, and I think that Rabbi Berman alluded to this, that 30, 40 years ago, it was not typical for women to be able to learn Gemara. It was so rare to be taught Gemara. It was almost impossible to find a place to study Gemara. But when Rabbi Khan came here, which was way before I got here, and he started teaching Gemara at Stern, in the beginning his classes were pretty small, and it was a small showing for a bit. But as the years went on, he just continued teaching and continued teaching. And when GPATS got opened, of course, Rabbi Khan was there teaching since the very first day. And in those early days of GPATS, you know, the program was so new, we didn't even have a name. We call it GPATS now. It was the program back then. And us women, I was in the second class, and we were criticized and we were teased, and lots of interesting names were given to us. And Rabbi Khan just kept saying to us, don't worry about it. Just don't care and just keep on learning. And the amazing thing is you fast forward now 20 years and Rav Khan has created an empire. There are hundreds of women who learn Gemara, thousands who are learning from his students. So my message to start is just for all of you that Gemara is much more accessible for you and that there are classes for you to take and opportunities, don't take those for granted. They weren't here. And if we don't take on those opportunities, they may not continue to be there for us. So I encourage all of you, continue to learn Torah on the highest of levels, continue to learn Gemara and appreciate that Rav Khan paved the way for all of us. But as I mentioned a second ago, I didn't sit in this room all those years ago because the Beit Midrash was on the sixth floor. So in this room, I feel Rabbi Khan, but I feel Rabbi Khan right over there on the table where he used to sit all the time, sitting and learning in his Gemara, unless a student or me interrupted him, which I did all the time. And I would sit down across from him and we would just chat. And we would chat about GPATS, or we would chat about life and what was going on, or very often a very specific student that he was very worried about. But the most special memory I have in this room, and I would say probably one of the most fondest memories I have of Rav Khan, is GPATS graduation. GPATS graduation, always in this room, standing here at the pulpit. And we should all know, if you don't know the story, the last time that Rav Khan was here at Stern was at last year's GPATS graduation. And because of COVID and his condition, Rav Khan hasn't been in this building for a very long time, a number of years already. He taught exclusively on Zoom, and he taught really almost up to, you know, the very end. He really just wanted to teach his students Torah all the time. But he wanted to make a point to come here for GPATS graduation last year. And I remember I was so privileged because I got to spend 2 hours with him in the car, driving him here and driving him home with the windows open and the masks on and every other precaution that he wanted. But I got to talk to him just about how things were going and life. And I just got to listen to him talk. And he explained to me how important it was that he continues to learn to teach Gemara, even behind a computer screen, how much he loved his students, how much he loved GPATS, and how strongly he believed in women's Talmud Torah, specifically learning Gemara. But my memory of him sitting here and standing here, I would say, at GPATS graduation always makes me smile, because anyone from GPATS knows we have a beautiful tradition at GPATS. At every graduation, going back all the way from the beginning, 20 plus years ago, the faculty speaks about every single student. And basically, we split up the faculty to talk about and highlight the talents and the unique characteristics of every single student. So every year, Rabbi Khan would come here and with his index cards, I don't know why, always on index cards, and he would base his speech on the sixth chapter of Pirkei Avot. And he would find amongst all the different lists and traits that are found in Pirkei Avos, something that perfectly described that student that he was talking about. So I thought it was only fitting today, in honor of Rabbi Khan's memory, to look towards the words of Pirkei Avot. happens to be I took out the Mishnah and I just opened it at random and I found myself looking down onto the words Aseh Lecha Rav. Make for yourself a teacher, and certainly Rabbi Kahn was my teacher. Just to be a little personal, I did not have the opportunity to learn Gemara in high school. Where I went, we were not allowed to open a Gemara. So I started learning Gemara in my 2 years of Israel, but I really learned Gemara when I came here to Stern and took Rav Kahn's classes for 5 years. And I can say with certainty he made me the teacher I am today. But he is not just my teacher. He is the teacher, as you know, of hundreds of women, so many who now teach Torah to hundreds and thousands more. And there is no question in my mind that each and every single one of you have numerous teachers in your high school seminaries here at Stern that are Talmidot of Rav Kahn. I started to make a list and then I realized I will insult a lot of people if I start listing off who are his students that are probably your teachers. But you have to understand, just sitting here, there are three here at Stern College that were all in his classroom. But I continue to read the Mishnayos, and I went backwards in the Mishnah. And before the words Aseh Lecha Rav, it struck me that this really pertained to Rav Kahn. Because you see, a different highlight of GPATS was, used to be, since we got so big now, but our yearly Shabbaton. And our yearly Shabbaton, we should still do this aspect of it. We would have a question and answer session on Shabbos afternoon with Rav Kahn, Rav Berger, Rav Nachman, and myself on the panel. One of these things did not belong, but I was there too. The students always gave us a list of questions, and it always included the following question: how do I keep up my learning after I leave GPATS? And Rav Kahn always answered first, always, every time, always answered first. And he would give over the following message, which was right there in that page of Pirkei Avot that I was looking at. Asei Toratz HaKeva, that's what he would say. Make a set time for learning. He would give a whole speech how you have to set aside time every single day and make sure that you're learning on the highest of levels, you know, like an hour a day, every day, take out your Gemara. And he would just give us this whole speech every single time. But it was so impressive to hear him speak. And then he would talk about his stories of Amelus Batorah and how many hours he spends learning Torah every single day and what he learned every year of his life. And it was just awe-inspiring. But then I kept reading that Mishnah and it continued to remind me of Rav Kahn because the next words were Amor Ma'at Va'asei Harbeh. Say a little, but do a lot. And you know what? I think we would all agree, being his students, Rav Kahn didn't preach about what he did. He just did it. He just taught every day, day in, day out for 40 years or more. He didn't give grand speeches. He didn't tell us why it was important to learn Torah. He didn't critique those who disagreed with him. He just taught by example. And the mission then continues some more. Vehaveh mekabel es kol hadam b'sever panim yafot. Receive all people with a kind face. And that's exactly Rabbi Kahn. There was always a smile. There was a twinkle in his eye, if you could see it, when you were talking to him, or of course, if you got the answer right that he was asking you about in class. But he always quoted from the sixth parak of Avot, so I had to go there. So I picked a few to apply to Rav Kahn. There were so many, it was hard. First to describe, I would say, his biggest accomplishment, halomed amenat lalamed, to learn in order to teach. Rav Kahn spent his entire adult life teaching Torah. That's all he wanted to do. That's what he did every single day. As we heard, didn't care about the politics. He didn't care if people agreed with him, disagreed with him. He ignored, as he told me, I ignore the noise. That was his words. I ignore the noise and I will just keep teaching Torah. And this is something that on that day that the three of us went to his home a few weeks before he passed us, what he said to us again, just keep learning and teaching Torah. Keep your head down and just keep teaching. And that's exactly what he did. But that leads me to the next line that I want to quote from the Mishnah to describe him, which was mitrachek min hakavod. He didn't run after honor. He didn't want rewards. He didn't want recognition. He just wanted a place to teach Torah, and he wanted students who wanted to learn Torah. But one of the things that I think he didn't realize, and we wanted to make sure he understood before he passed away, is the final word that I want to quote from that Mishnah, which is ahuv, loved. He didn't know how much he was loved by his students. I think his family didn't realize how much he was treasured by all of the women that he taught. But the overwhelming response to his passing is a tribute, I believe, to how much he was loved. So many letters, as you know, and articles have been written about him, the shiurim and the drashot that have been dedicated in his memory. the amazing amount of Shloshim events that have been in his honor all around the world, the Siyum of Shas that we did yesterday, which we have to stop for a minute to realize the entire Shas was learned in less than 30 days. It's actually incredible, only in his honor. And I think the part that would make him the most proud is that the Siyum was made mostly by women. Women that were students and his grand students, and I think Rabbi Berger pointed this out, more than 450 people learned in his honor. So you may wonder, you know, what should we learn from Rabbi Kahn? How should we continue in his legacy? So I'll tell you the story that I already told a group of Rabbi Kahn students when we found out that he wasn't returning into the school building, which I think would be the message Rabbi Kahn would want me to give you today. I remember I was in GPATS on 9/11, 2001. Sitting in the Stern Beit Midrash, and this had a very profound effect on me. We all found out the news. We were sitting there. We were in a shock that a plane hit the Twin Towers, and we were panicking. The subways were shut down. The buses were shut down. We didn't know what to do. We were just sitting there. What do we do? And Rav Kahn came into the Beit Midrash. He's like, I don't understand. Why are you confused? Of course you know what to do. He's like, keep learning. What else are you going to do? And we spent the entire day, because the subways didn't start running until much later that evening, we spent the entire day just learning Torah together. So I think that is the message, and that is the legacy of Rav Kahn. Keep learning, keep growing, and through our learning, we will all keep Rav Kahn's legacy alive. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Thank you.
Pirshus, all of my colleagues and all the guests who are here. Really rather overwhelming to be standing here. I didn't realize how overwhelming it would be until I got up just now. And that photo right above where Rav Kahn used to sit exactly like that, at that table, in this room every day. A lot has been said about how the Beis Medrash that we have is basically here because of Rabbi Kahn. And as so many of us have been saying that, I was looking around the room and I realized that the real tribute to Rabbi Kahn, the real indication of what he has meant and will continue to mean, is not the room, sixth floor, seventh floor, little leaves embedded in the wall or not, but the wall of Sfarim over there. You might notice that the Chidushei HaRamban and the Chidushei HaRashba and the Chidushei HaRitva and the Rambams and all the other Sfarim here in this section of the Beis Medrash do not look brand new. They're used, their spines are torn, some of them are tattered. Those Sfarim that will continue to be on those shelves in the years to come and will continue to be opened and continue to be studied and continue to be learned. That is really what is in this room that reflects the legacy of Rav Kahn. When we the GPATS faculty, sat down with our students on the first day of the semester, Rav Kahn, of course, passed away during intercession. So there was one thing that I emphasized that Mrs. Price kind of asked me to make a point of if I speak again, so I'm gonna say it again, which is that as much as Rav Kahn did for women's Torah learning, which he basically built with the inspiration of Soloveitchik, as Rabbi Berman talked about before, there could have been a world of women's learning today, 40 years later, that was very different from the world of women's learning that we actually have. Rav Soloveitchik gave the first shiur and inspired Rav Kahn to continue to teach women and to teach Gemara. But how was he going to do it? What was the curriculum going to be? What was the nature of the shiur going to be? It's interesting that Rabbi Berman mentioned that the Rav decided that the right thing to learn in that first semester was Arvei Pesachim. Well, if somebody tried to get Rav Kahn to learn Arve Psachim and G-Pats, he would not have allowed that at all. Nashim and Nezikin, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Shavuos, Gittin, Kiddushin. He insisted that the Talmud Torah that was going to be opened up to the world of Jewish women and made available to Jewish women was going to be the same Torah that he had learned, the same Torah that he had been taught, the same Torah that had been handed to him. And it's very tempting when pioneering something new to try to leapfrog the hard stuff and to try to, we need to show success in the first 6 months and we need to graduate people who can say they did X, Y, or Z in the next 2 years. It's so easy to feel the need to be able to show that we accomplished something. And as a result, to stay away from the hard stuff. And if that had been the ground level of women's Torah learning, which it easily could have been 40 years ago, we never would be where we are today. I would not have the career that I have. I would not have the students that I have. I would not have students who would be able to learn in the shiur that I now give. It's all because Rabbi Kahn insisted on everyone who was in his shiur learning, spending the time, putting it in the effort, doing the hard stuff, learning the difficult material, and learning everything about the difficult material. And it is that learning that tattered the Sfarim that are on the shelves here today. I have a little bit more to say, although as President Berman stole Mrs. Schechter's thunder, Mrs. Price stole mine a little bit. No, not the actual substance, but the frame and the form, which is that I also thought very much about the GPAT's graduation, standing in this very spot. And so I'm going to cut it short a little bit since we're running late. Let me just finish with a quick thought. I mentioned this to the students also a few weeks ago. Whenever Rav Kahn got up at graduation to speak, sometimes he spoke about the students. There were years when he gave more of a regular address and didn't speak about the individual students. But in either case, I always got the sense that he was a little bit uncomfortable. Rav Kahn was a Rebbe. As far as I know, he was never a community rabbi. He gave great and deep and sophisticated shiurim. I got the impression that when he got up to give a more of a drasha, that was something that he had to put a lot more work into than it wasn't, so to speak, what he was used to doing. And the degree of thoughtfulness and effort that was so clear he had put into preparing every one of those addresses, as Mrs. Price mentioned, with the note cards and everything. So, and that itself demonstrated, you could sort of exuding from him the both the love and the care and the respect that he had for his students, that he wanted to do that for them. Let me just mention, without all of the introduction, since it's already been provided, one line from Perek Kinyan Torah, the sixth Perek of Pirkei Avos, to say one more word about Rabbi Kahn, which is that one of the descriptions of the person who is Kona Torah is Velo Magis Libo B'Talmudo, which is even a little bit difficult to translate. Magis from the word like arrogance, not megis his heart in his learning. And a lot of the mefarshim, the simple explanation, of course, means that someone, in order to acquire Torah, has to be humble, can't think of him or herself as better than or higher than the people with whom he or she is learning. The problem is that anava, humility, was already mentioned earlier in the list in this Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. So what's being added by lo megis libo b'talmudo? So I'm going to skip some of what I was going to say and just mention one one rather startling interpretation of the Tiferes Yisrael. He says that the word megis here does not come from the word from the notion of gasos ruach of arrogance, but rather is connected with the phrase we have elsewhere in the Gemara, libo gasba, which refers to a relationship between two people in which the two people are particularly familiar with each other, very close, know each other very well. It comes up in a couple of different areas of halacha. And what does that have to do with Kinyan Torah? So the Tiferes Yisrael says that when a person is learning Torah, the person shouldn't put themselves in a position of choshevas atzmo kiragil ima. A person's relationship with the Torah shouldn't be one that's so overly familiar, like your best friends. He compares, and we're not going to read anymore in the interest of time, but he compares the relationship a person should have with the Torah that he or she is learning as the relationship of someone to a person with whom he is engaged rather than married. A relationship in which there is a familiarity, but a still a kind of distance and almost a kind of withdrawal. And that if a person becomes overly familiar with the Torah, like you sit down to open a Gemara and the Gemara is your best friend, right? Then you're not going to give the Torah the respect that it's due, and you're also not going to learn it well enough because you're just going to be shooting the breeze with your buddy. Rather, you need to open up, every time you open up a Gemara, there should be a sense of reverence, a sense of distance. And I think this is something that Rav Kahn, both in his own learning and in his teaching, reflected so well. Rav Kahn was someone, as you talked about before, that's what he looked like for hours every day, poring over the Gemara. It would have been very easy for the Gemara to have become Rav Kahn's best friend. But every single time Rav Kahn opened up a Gemara, he was not in the presence of his friend, he was in the presence of his teachers. He was in the presence of something that was awe-inspiring to him, something that he felt a responsibility to respect enough to get it right. And that is what he did in his own learning, and that is also, as we've heard so often in these last few weeks, a message that he has imparted over so many years to so many students, a message that has carried them so well for generations now. And as I conclude as I began, and how it is reflected in the Sfarim that line the walls in this Beis Medrash, and we can have a Chatzi Nechama that in the decades to come, people will continue to learn in this Beis Medrash without the benefit of Rav Kahn's Shir, but will continue to learn from those very same Sfarim and imbibe the very same messages. Thank you.
Bershus, the Kahn family, my own Rebbeim, colleagues, and of course the Talmidot. I'd like to focus my address this evening just by highlighting three important qualities of Rav Kahn that speak to me, and I'd like to share with you, particularly the Talmidot, that Bezrat Hashem could carry with you as we move forward from this moment. The first quality of Rav Kahn that I'd like to highlight is the quality of substance over style, substance over show. I think this reflected itself both in his learning and also in his personal character. In terms of his learning, we say in the Berachos Kriyat Shema every single morning after we recite Kriyat Shema, Emes v'yatziv v'nachon v'kayam v'yashar v'ne'eman v'ahuv v'chaviv v'nechmad v'na'im v'nora v'adir mitukan u'mikubal v'tov v'yafeh. And there's a great distance in that lineup between the opening word Emes and the final word Yafeh. And oftentimes, there could be a great distance between the two. And I don't believe that Rav Kahn was against elegance and elegance in learning, but it always had to be measured against the barometer, against the measuring stick of MS, of what was truthful. And I think this informs both the rigor of his learning, the precision of his learning, the truthfulness of his learning, the na'im, the nechmad, the yafeh. It always had to be measured and seen through the prism of MS, of what was truth and his attention to the truth of Torah, in everything that he did. But this quality of substance over style, substance over show, also reflected itself in his personal character. And one of my favorite Gemarot Gemara Masachet Sanhedrin and Daf Pechad and Medbat. The Gemara there tells us that they sent a message from Eretz Yisrael, and they wondered, Ezehu ben Olam Haba, who's going to be worthy, deserving of a chelak in Olam Haba? And the answer that was given to that question, Ezehu ben Olam Haba, was Anvasan Ushval Berech, Shayef Ayel, Shayef Inafich, the Garis Baraisa Tadira, Flamaksik Tivusa Lanavshei. The answer to that question was, someone who is exceedingly, exceedingly humble, does not have an arrogant bone in his body. He enters quietly and he leaves quietly, but all the while he's engaged assiduously in the study of Torah. And never once is machzik tova liatzmo, never once is looking for awards, for accolades, for honors, to machzik tova to himself. Just goes about his business, knows the mission at hand, and that's enough to call his attention. That's enough to invest himself fully in the task at hand. And when that message was issued, without any fanfare, without any calling attention to oneself, the entire base medrash turned and looked at Ula Bar Abba. Because apparently, even though he fit that description, everyone who knew him knew that was a perfectly fitting description of who he was, what his essence was. And when I think about this Gemara, and I look at that picture, and I recall many memories of time, hours shared in this space, I couldn't imagine a better description of what Rav Khan was all about. Anvasan Ushval Berech, someone who's exceedingly humble, not a single arrogant bone in his body, Shayef Ayel V'Shayef Nafik, never calling too much attention to himself, never the fanfare, quietly entered, quietly left. The only thing I would add to the Gemara's description, with his coffee mug in hand that he'd been put down on the table, but entered quietly, left quietly, and Kolzman that he was here, Garis Boraisa Tadira, focused on the task at hand in the important work of studying Kadosh Baruch Hu's Torah, disseminating that and sharing that with all the Talmidot that learned together with him. And never once Machzik Tova Liatzmo. If I would apply to this situation, I would say, could all turn and say and look at Rav Moshe ben Rav Moshe Yosef ben Chaim Umechla, it's Rav Moshe Khan. We know with that description, who that description is describing. Rav Khan worked hard. He was always humble. He was engaged in the Melechas HaKodesh, and nothing needed to animate him more than the importance of the work that he did. And if there's one message that I could leave with all the Talmidot here to take with them, is to work hard, to be humble, to accomplish great things, and then remain humble afterward. And you know where you get that from in looking at Rav Khan. The second quality that I wanted to highlight is principle over perception. Rav Khan was one of the most principled people that I knew. Everything that guided his decisions, his actions, was the principles that he held dear to himself. What is considered to be Tov Yashar B'nei Hashem, and what is Tov Yashar in my understanding as to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me here in this world. He didn't care about, let alone cower, to the perceptions of others. He thought about what is Tov Yashar, and that's what guided his decisions. That's what led him to how he should conduct himself, how he should proceed, the decisions that he made. As Mrs. Price mentioned before, and if I could just add a certain twist to it, there's no shortage of noise out there. And if there's one message that I can deliver to the students this evening, is that your time and energy is too precious to waste on noise. Focus on the things that are important in life. Focus your attention, focus your energies on substance, on meaning, in productive engagement, on things that are lasting and enduring in this world, and you could change the world just like Rav Khan changed the world. And the final message that I wanted to deliver this evening was something that was, I know, held dearly by Rav Khan, and that is the distinction between active learning and passive learning. A little bit of, in a countercultural type of way, we live in a culture very much of shiur attendance, listening to shiurim, accessing shiurim. I'm not in any way belittling the importance of all those outlets to learn and to learn in all contexts and all forums. Not in any way meaning to belittle that. But I think for Rav Khan, the difference between passive learning, which is imbibing and listening, hearing, to others teach and others present, in his mind was never equated with and never on par with active learning. and it informed the entire way that he approached education, the entire way that he taught his shiur. The Seder time in the Beis Medrash was sacrosanct, far more than the shiur time in which that was reviewed and gone over. But it was the Seder time. That's where the Tamid and Kesidrim were offered. That's where one had to roll up their sleeves and get to work. That's where the effort had to be invested. And that's where the real gain and growth was to be achieved. He was there to always guide the learning, but it was the active learning of the students that he always looked to foster, not the passive learning of listening and hearing to others present to them. In fact, a number of years ago, we made the decision that we wanted to have a Makshava Shir once a week that would unify all parts of the GPATS program, one Gemara Shir, the other Gemara Shir, members of the Tanakh program, to have a joint learning enterprise, everyone together. And to have Rav Khan sign off on having that Makshava Shir once a week for a half hour was a Herculean effort. When was it going to take place? How much of Seder time would be lost, both to the Shir? Would the Shir end on time? And how efficiently will the students return to the Beis Medrash after the Shir is over? How many precious moments and minutes of Seder time are going to be lost to the Makshava Shir? I personally am the one who delivers that Shir. I never think of it or conceive of it in terms of Bittul Torah. But at the same time, it was very clear to me always the distinction between passive learning and active learning. And for Rav Khan, the active learning that all of you do here in the Beit Midrash, that was primary. That was the most important piece. We should never confuse the passive absorption of Torah to the active engagement of Torah. Seder time was always sacred. And as Mrs. Price mentioned before, whenever that question came up, on question and answer sessions, how can I continue? How should I continue my learning afterward, after I conclude my formal study here within the institution? His advice was always the same. It was never find a good shir to go to, find a good shir to listen to, and not to belittle the importance of that. But lo harei zeh ke harei zeh, it doesn't begin to compare with the active learning that one engages in, where one is toiling with the sources. One might not advance as quickly or as efficiently, but that's where the real work happens. That's where the real growth happens. That's where the kinyan of Torah happens. And that was always something that he highlighted and advised the women, that once you leave, you need to make sure to carve out time. And it's going to require active effort to carve out those open spaces, to engage in learning. Life can very quickly fill the open spaces. You need to carve out that open space. You also always advise them, set up a chavrusa. Because without a chavrusa, without that hitchayvut, to learn with someone else, it could easily be overrun by many of the responsibilities and the pressures of life. But to continue learning in an active way, even once you move beyond the formal educational experience here within the institution. It is such an honor and a privilege to reflect on Rav Khan, on his personal character, on his learning, on everything that he has left us. There's no doubt in my mind that everything that we have accomplished and everything that we will continue to accomplish, Bezrat Hashem, in this space, is all going to be built, an edifice that is built upon the foundation that he has laid for us. Yehi Zichro Baruch.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. The program has concluded. Sorry we went a little bit long. We really appreciate you all coming out and hearing our memories about Rabbi Khan, and all of us should just continue in his legacy and just keep on learning Torah. And thank you for coming.